Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings, and I want to tell you all about my show, the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast, here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. On the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast, we do a thorough analysis on the biggest issues and trends within the pro wrestling industry. We talk a lot about pro wrestling media, we talk a lot about fan culture and wrestling's place within general pop culture, and we talk about the broader influences that are shaping the way we discuss and analyze the pro wrestling industry. We've had some of the brightest minds in the pro wrestling intelligentsia on the show, including WrestleNomics host Brandon Thurston, both Rich Kreich and Joe Lanza from the Flagship Wrestling Podcast, Trevor Dame from the Through the Years podcast, and a whole lot more. This isn't a show for hot takes. It's not a show recapping the latest episode of television. This is a show focusing on the biggest topics in pro wrestling and doing a deep dive on the real stories behind the surface level analysis you might find elsewhere. The Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a try. Thanks.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Kids, do you like pro wrestling? Well, you're kind of out of luck because you're only going to get a couple of those questions. This is the Ask Us Anything Holiday Spectacular, but we each gave each other a Vader Club pick. Chris chose Shibata versus Ishii from G1 2023, and I picked Midnight Express versus the Fantastics from World Class Championship Wrestling's Parade of Champions in 1985. I am Jeff Hawkins. He is Chris Novembrino. Still recovering, but battling through it.
Yeah. I mean, every time we tape, it's getting a little bit better. But, it's just, this ear infection is just, it has been very stubborn, is what it has been.
Well, you know, Van Gogh was an artist. He just chopped off his ear, and that wouldn't stop it, though, because it's inner ear.
No. And that would still result in the problem of me not being able to hear. It's like... I've been working on music and I'm kind of like stuck. But, you know, I'm like, well, I'm not gonna let this get to me. I'm gonna try to keep living my life. I tried to have one of those.
Oh,
and I realized that this is still very much jacking up like every facet of my day. I got a new keyboard, and I'm working on a track. I like it, but I was like, you know what? I'm gonna slap a mix on this thing. So I tried to do that. And I ended up having to keep turning the headphones to the good ear to check the levels, and I was hating life. I was just like, this is horrible. This is not a fun way of having to mix music or really do anything.
Well, let's get to it. We have 10 questions. We will sandwich it with the two wrestling questions. We did do prep, I hope. I did, because I had to remember what movies have come out since 2005 that I need to remember. But predict the state of AEW at the end of the new TV contract. Okay. I think they'll probably be down around 400,000 to 500,000 viewers a week. I think both the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega will resign their vice presidencies. The Bucks to basically retire / do indies or maybe even a WWE run. And I think Kenny Omega's in Japan full time.
So the contract is 3-4 years, right?
Three with an option for a fourth.
I don't think they get optioned. I think their ratings are hanging around 400,000 or so, a little bit above, a little bit below. Maybe 425, 450. I'm kind of with you. I see the Bucks and a lot of the team that was there at the launch not being there.
Yeah.
And a question of, you know, where is Darby Allin? Where is MJF? the Jack Perry, the guys you named as the young pillars of the company, can they do anything at that point? I mean, Darby, the way he's wrestling, might be, you know, on a reduced duty 3 years from now. So
no, that's a good point. I think the ratings for TV will still be good, because I still think I think all this cord cutting and people going to streaming and whatnot, I do think it will remain a trend. I think it's not going to be enough to cancel them. I mean, they're not going to be like, oh, you know, they're in danger of getting canceled because they're not getting enough viewers. They're going to be in that top five for the night. I don't have a lot of faith in Tony Khan to build marquee stars that get more media attention than the juggernaut that is up in Stamford right now. And I do think, I don't know this for certain because I don't know backstage stuff, but I think the Bucks and Kenny are just going to say, this isn't our vision anymore, and we've kind of done all we can here. And I think they're going to peace out. Now, the ones that are going to be interesting, I think Mercedes will also eventually head back to WWE. I don't know how long her contract is, but I believe it was for 3. And she'll be out. Jericho. Jericho's going to go wherever we'll put him on TV. But I do think eventually he's going to be a WWE Hall of Famer, and he's going to want to partake in that too.
Oh, so I also think that WWE is going to need a high-profile celebrity, former WWE guy for the Mania season. And Jericho's phone is very much taking calls.
For whenever his I don't know how long his contract is. It won't be this year, but you know, maybe in a couple years.
Not this Mania season. But I mean, like the inroad for Jericho is going to be Mania season some year from now.
And that Tony will continue to hire people who get great buzz on the indies and are good workers.
And have no idea how to present them.
Pretty much. I mean,
yeah, like I think the company over the next couple few years probably, I don't know that they run in the red, but I think they have a number of shows that finish off in the red where they spent more money putting the show together than they made at the gate.
I think also Tony makes a deal with someone very interesting. I don't know who, but it's going to be a name where we go, oh, they'll never be able to coexist. And they probably won't, but he's going to try something to get buzz going. I don't know if he makes a move for Heyman or if he decides to bring Cornette in or something to that. Someone of that level, I think it would not shock me if he tried.
I could see him getting desperate, try to do the Team of Rivals thing, bring in Cornette, who at once could tell him some of what is wrong with his product, but also doesn't necessarily know how to fix it either.
Right.
Like Cornette's very good at the don't do this, don't do that, but he seldom burdens himself with
what does work.
Right, and how to make these guys, the current team that I'm dealing with, work. You know, it's one thing to be like, well, just shouldn't have so-and-so as our quarterback. Okay, yeah, no, I get that. But, like, what if that's our quarterback? What's the strategy then?
What brings you joy, Chris?
Oh, what brings me joy? A number of things. I like making music. It is one thing that throughout my life, I mean, even when I'm sick and I can't even fully hear it, it is always stimulating, relaxing, engaging, and educational to be writing or playing music. I enjoy practicing. I find joy in practice. I like sitting down and doing scalar exercises and trying to get better and faster at them. Some other things that bring me joy, I love my cats. I adore them. They are absolute treasures, and they're always cuddly. And whenever I'm having a bad day, or even when I'm just having an okay day but it's busy, they always remind me to stop and, you know, take time to just lay on the floor with them, and I'm really always grateful for that. And then finally, Oliver brings me joy. Having Oliver living in the house,
the audience does not know who Oliver is, I believe.
Yeah, they wouldn't. We have a not complicated, but a hard to sort of like summarize titularly dynamic, but I guess it's sort of like older brother, younger brother. Oliver and I think both view each other as family members, and I live with him now, and I enjoy it brings me great joy, even when I have to castigate him for behaviors that I have been guilty of in the past, and to count and I always add the rejoinder of, yeah, I do that shit too. All of those things bring me joy.
There is no better feeling for me, and I don't get this anymore because I don't perform as much, but if doing a comedy show, be it stand-up or improv, where you have absolutely killed in front of a full house, I can't get to sleep 3 hours after the show. It's such a amazing vibe to know that you've entertained people at least for like 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is that you've done the show. I'd like to get that back, but it's one of those things where comedy is kind of a young person's game unless you've made a name for yourself, and I haven't. And I see, because what doesn't bring me joy is everything leading up to getting up on that stage, which is just a pain in the ass, dealing with bookers, dealing with producers, just trying out for stand-up. For stand-up, trying out material is just the worst, because you can't get a real good barometer of it at open mic nights usually, because it's just other comics who don't want to laugh at you for the most part. So there's that gunfighter mentality. I love radio. I've always loved doing radio and talking into a microphone, so I enjoy podcasting immensely. I don't necessarily enjoy the subjects I talk about all the time, but I enjoy doing this type of stuff. It is no secret, I think I've put it out here, I really like water slides. I do. I think water slides are one of the few pleasures. Thrill rides. I can't do roller coasters anymore that much, so water slides will have to do, and I enjoy the thrill of those, which will probably lead me into my answer for the next question. But Chris,
I'm going to add on a couple more here. Teaching. I love teaching.
Okay.
One of the great joys of my life, honestly, has been seeing some of my students that I was teaching in their teenage years now moving into, 18, 19, 20, and actually doing paying gigs and seeing that the fruits of my labor have paid off. And then lastly, go-karts.
Go-karts are nice.
I love go-karts. They're fun, man. And I love a good game of Mario Kart, too.
Making people feel bad, destroying their dreams. Those are other things that bring me joy that I can't really talk about on the air too much, but I won't.
I thought you were referencing dropping people into the pit of Wario's stadium. Like hitting that lightning bolt on your friend right as they're about to go for the jump on Wario's stadium and hearing their groan as they fall into the pit with the question mark boxes, knowing that they're never going to catch up in this race ever again. That's a great moment. That sparks joy, too.
Chris, what is your favorite vacation spot in the continental U.S.?
Favorite vacation spot in the continental U.S.? Probably New Orleans. Even though I don't drink, I like going to a vacation spot where stuff's happening at all hours of the day. I want like a living, active, busy city, because I'm not there for a long time. I'm there for a short time. And I want to have as much fun as possible. And like New Orleans, you can go out and go and hang out, walk around the town. It's 2 a.m, still stop somewhere and eat something lovely. Love that.
I like Orlando a lot. It's hard not to. There's just a variety of different parks and stuff to do out there while being in Florida. I will say I really, really loved the Wisconsin Dells when I went, which is, for those who don't know, largest per capita area of water slides in the world. Just every kind of water park you can think of. My problem is I can't go on vacation alone anymore because like I'll book a week and then by Wednesday I'm depressed because it's like it's me and that's it. So it's one of those things. So but the Wisconsin Dells was a lot of fun. And then like just the weird Midwestern charm of like the lumberjack breakfast in town, which is, you know, it's like seating, so you have to sit with other people and you know pass things around and take them off the play. The weird communal energy of that. There is some kitschy small town nonsense in there. Like I believe there's like one, you know, there's a Ripley's Believe It or Not, which I didn't go to, but there's a lot of little craft stores, and there was a really good popcorn store in town in the Wisconsin Dells that had like 50 flavors of popcorn. And I'm just like, yeah, I'll take a few of each of these type of a thing. So I really enjoyed the one time I did go to the Wisconsin Dells. That was a lot of fun. I don't do a lot of vacations. A lot of my vacations are spent like doing comedy if I did. So it was like one of those things where I'm kind of there to work at the same time. So I didn't enjoy myself. New Orleans also a strong pick. Don't get me wrong. Your favorite movie, Chris? I don't know if I even have asked you this off air before.
Okay, so my favorite movie is Alien, but wow. a close second would be Dr. Strangelove, which actually strong. I sat down and showed my roommate Oliver and my girlfriend here this week, and they all enjoyed it.
I just recently rewatched Alien, and how much I enjoy all the setup of the class struggle on the ship before the alien even appears, where Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton's character are like, we want our full share of bonuses because we're doing as much of the work as anybody. And kind of the white collar scientist guys are like, you know, you're going to get what everybody else gets, you know, or what you signed on to get type of a thing. It's a little akin to why Predator works so much, is that they introduce all the guys in the squad and, you know, they all have interpersonal relationships and they're all doing all these other things. And then by the time the Predator drops halfway through the movie, you kind of care about them and starts picking them off one by one. Yeah. Walter Hill. I'm a big Walter Hill fan. So I enjoy Alien a lot more than Aliens, which is more of a sci-fi action movie. And it doesn't have as much of I enjoy it for a different reason. And I also, oddly enough, I enjoy Alien 3 more than most people do. I really like the prison planet setup. My favorite movie is 1969's The Wild Bunch by Sam Peckinpah. I was a first year at the University of Virginia, and they were doing the Festival of American Film. And they're, you know, a bunch of different movies that they were seeing, and I went to a symposium on violence in cinema that did Bonnie and Clyde and the Wild Bunch, and I was absolutely sold. I love westerns as a genre. This is a genre, or this is a movie where there are no good guys. There are just various levels of bad guys. The old West is starting to come to an end. And so William Holden and Ernest Borgnine and Ben Johnson and Warren Oates are cowboys who have kind of outlived their usefulness in this time and space, and they can see it. And it's the whole, we'll do one last big score. And then, but all of them have like these certain self-destructive properties that eventually culminate in what happens at the end. It is bloody. It is beautiful. It's long. It's 2.5 hours, but it is absolutely captivating, and I love every moment of it. Speaking of which, grouped this one in here, Chris, because it's the pop culture section. What are your top three movies and albums released since 2005, so I'm guessing he's going with the last 20 years here, given that I like old school stuff so much.
Yeah, okay. Movies, I think probably a little easier for me to go with than albums, interestingly enough. Or the albums are going to be a little more like obscure. I might have.
I'm going obscure as well, so don't worry about it.
Yeah. All right. So, movies wise, I've got to go No Country for Old Men. I'm going to say There Will Be Blood. I think both of those in 2006 were absolute classics. And I will also tack in there have been a lot of good horror movies in recent years. Just to name a couple that I think are going to be kind of classics longer term. It Follows, I think, is outstanding.
Is that no, that's not the tire one.
No. It's a monster that follows people. It Follows 2 stunk, but yeah, It Follows 1 was quite good. And the other one that I would recommend that I really liked, The Babadook. I thought The Babadook was quite a good movie, very entertaining and good horror movie. Recently, I saw Heretic with Hugh Grant, and I really liked that too. I thought Hugh Grant's performance in that was excellent.
When I first sat down to write these, my first two were No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. So I'll strike the No Country for Old Men because I had already struck There Will Be Blood. But I really liked Casino Royale. I liked the reboot of Bond. I thought it was done very, very smart, very, very well, making Daniel Craig kind of an unsympathetic, cold, blunt instrument of MI6 or MI5. I forget which one it is. The Dark Knight is not just a great comic book movie. It is a great movie of which I still talk about certain things and certain themes that are not entirely clear in that movie. It's just fantastic. And then since you picked No Country for Old Men, I'll go with something in a similar vein, or at least a similar genre. I really liked Hell or High Water from 2016 with Chris Pine and Ben Foster. I think Ben Foster is vastly underrated as an actor. If you ever saw him in Alpha Dog or the remake of 310 to Yuma, he's just a ferocious character actor who goes deep into his things. And Chris Pine is so good in this. And I'm not a Star Trek guy. Chris is our Star Trek fan here, but I didn't think he had great chops necessarily, until I watched this movie. And, you know, Jeff Bridges, of course, is playing a fantastic, take on kind of a brash, uncaring sheriff who just wants to track these two bank robbing brothers down. But it's written by Tyler Sheridan, who is of course responsible for, you know, Yellowstone and that entire franchise there. But it's a really fantastic, if you like No Country for Old Men, kind of a similar vein without the overlying thing of what is the nature of evil, which is my favorite part of Cormac McCarthy's books are all like that, you know, Blood Meridian, The Road. You know, there's always that, you know, there's a hint of supernaturalness in Cormac McCarthy's that's not in this one, but it's a darn good movie. Your albums, Chris.
You know, albums wise, I'm going to go more with artists here.
Okay.
So I really love the Budos Band. They are a very, very cool act. Donnie Benet, I think, is doing a really fun sort of like throwbacky thing, clearly in on the joke with the image and everything that he's doing. I like him a lot. Diplomats of Solid Sound are really cool, kind of like an old school Memphis Stax sort of funk act. But in more recent years, they started in the 90s, but in more recent years here, they've started adding singers and stuff into the mix, and I really dig that. I'm trying to think of best album since 2005. That one's tricky, because you want to know why? Because the album as a genre
is kind of dead.
2005 is actually a really interesting year to sort of like pick as your landmark, because that is, in a lot of ways, when the art of the album really started to die the death, because iTunes at that point was really prevalent. People were downloading individual songs and everything anyways for a good 4, 5, 6 years at that point, file sharing was available in the late 90s. And you didn't see as much of an emphasis on making outstanding albums. I have been told, they're not necessarily my major jam, but I have definitely been told, and from what I've heard, it sounds quite good. Nonagon Infinity by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard is kind of a cool one. Nonagon Infinity is interesting. You'll like this, Jeff. Basically, it's an album meant to be played on shuffle and on repeat, because each track can flow into the next track. They spend a lot of time production-wise getting that to happen. I thought that was pretty cool. I'm trying to think if there's any like ones that are squeakers in that 2005, 2006 range that maybe I'm forgetting.
Most of mine are from like 2009 or 2000. So it's
what you got?
Well, I mean, like I thought about this question because it's like best albums aren't my favorite albums. Like I will give respect to like Adele 21 or something by Bruno Mars because I think Bruno Mars is very, very talented. Et cetera, et cetera. But mine were Rafael Sadiq, The Way I See It, which Rafael Sadiq may know from Tony, from the 80s or the early 90s. This was an album he wrote and produced in the style of a Motown album. So he recorded it with, I mean, it sounds like a Motown album. It's fantastic, especially the single from it, 100 Yard Dash, which is a fantastic song. And then I picked two kind of funk acts out of Austin, Texas, Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears. Tell them what your name is. Black Joe Lewis, excellent guitar player, sounds like James Brown. And the Honey Bears are the horn section for him. And then group I only recently heard about, but this is their 2009 album, T-Bird and the Breaks, called Learn About It. They are a blue-eyed soul funk collective out of Austin that's kind of on hiatus, although they did come out with an EP this past year. Backup singers, horn section, the things I love, heavy bass, so I those were my top three for the year.
I'll mention one other artist that has been putting out singles, has not put out an album yet, and I'm interested to see what happens when he finally does get around to recording a full album, if there's ever a market for it. He's a guy out of Thailand. His name is Phum Vifarit, and I might have completely mangled that. P-H-U-M.
He's not listening. Don't worry about it.
No, I know, but in case anyone wants to look him up, Jeff.
Yeah. Yes, I know.
P-H-U-M-V-I-P-H-U-R-I-T. He has this great song called Hello Anxiety that I think is just a really cool, pleasant, dreamy song. Kind of nails the vibe that the dude's trying to lay down. I'd love to hear a whole album of stuff kind of in that dreamy pop vein that he's been doing.
Where did I leave off here? What meal could you have for dinner every night and never get bored with? Ribeye. I could do so much with if you leave me like a 12 to 16 ounce ribeye and just say, this is what you have for dinner every day. I could do so much stuff with it. It wouldn't even be funny and I'd never get bored with it. It's just perfect for me. Nice and fatty meat. Can't really dry it out too much. Grind it into a burger. I can make fajitas. I can make a Philly cheesesteak. Ribeye. Brian Alvarez is correct on this. Choice.
I mean, if you had to have just like one ingredient that you could kind of go anywhere with, a ribeye is not a bad way to go, man. If we're just talking like one style of food that I could just kind of do indefinitely, Thai food. It's filling, but not heavy. It has the spice, but also spices in it so that it's not just heat. It's actually a pretty flavorful palate. And I like the amount of vegetables and stuff that Thai food typically uses. I mean, I'm trying to, like, eat more vegetables. I do feel better when I eat veggies along with my protein.
Are you heavy spice, like hot spice, like jumping on's easier than jumping off type? In your Thai food?
No, that is typically my wings approach, where the piper must be paid the next morning.
Yeah. Those are terrible, terrible days, by the way. I used to really love hot food and eating jalapenos and other things like that, and now I'm just like, I'm at that age where I'm like, oh, paying for it too heavy, cost too high, don't want
to
do that.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to really gauge if you're down for to be a king the next day and sit on your throne.
Bring your phone, bring your laptop, get some work done.
Every man a king. You're gonna be on that throne for a minute. So I don't know, but yeah, Thai food. I mean, other than that, brother, I could probably eat a Ricky's Nashville hot chicken sandwich every single day. I'm not even joking. Like, I wouldn't get it like super hot, but I'd get like a level two Ricky's out of Dallas.
Well, we'll save that for a second there. Will you and Chris be melting your face off at the upcoming Dead & Company residency at the Sphere?
Oh, hell yeah, brother. I mean, no, you there won't. There is nothing like an extended 10-minute Jerry Garcia guitar solo to help me cure whatever insomnia that I might be having at any given moment.
Jerry won't even be there. It's the Dead & Company, so it'll be John Mayer probably or something like that.
So they're not even gonna bring Jerry.
They might hologram Jerry at the Sphere.
That'd be cool.
I don't like the Grateful Dead. And it's not
boring, man.
And it has very little to do with their music. It has more to do with their fans that I had to deal with growing up.
What do you think of the music though? Like, I know that so much of them is cultural, but what do you think of the Grateful Dead's music?
There are songs I like. I mean, it's not bad music to me. The stuff that gets heavy radio play is perfectly, you know, catchy pop tunes. You know, the later stuff like Touch of Grey, and I really like the song Hell in a Bucket, but overall, I don't see it. You know, it's like I don't see how they are life changing in terms of their musicianship, and even like this, like Casey Jones is okay, don't get me wrong. What other? Give me some other songs here to remember. It's one of those things where I'm just like, it's their aura and their reputation. To me, they're a lot like REM.
In which REM is an infinitely more interesting.
Oh, I'm sure they are, but in terms
they're
of
not even close.
In terms hold on. Let me explain why I'm saying this. In terms of how I react to them, their reputation far exceeds my enjoyment of their music. Let's put it that way. I don't enjoy REM at all. I really don't. But
yeah, I'm actually a pretty big REM fan. Peter Buck's actually a pretty big influence on my guitar playing. I learned a lot of guitar back in the day off of REM stuff. I spent way more time learning REM than I did the Grateful Dead when I was learning how to play guitar.
It's weird because I like certain quote-unquote jam bands. Like, my favorite band is Traffic, which is the Winwood Capaldi one he did after Spencer Davis Group, but before Blind Faith and before his solo stuff. And I love the Allman Brothers Band to death. I could go to their concerts forever back in the day. In 1994, the summer, Capaldi and Winwood got together for basically what was a Winwood solo album that turned into a Traffic project that wasn't really Traffic. But they were playing like a lot of their greatest hits and stuff. So there were some.
My dad took me to that tour.
There were some Traffic. There were a lot of old Traffic songs. And I enjoyed the hell out of the concert I went to. But the prospect of following them stopped the moment that they were doing stadium shows as openers for the Dead. And I wasn't having any of that. Look, I don't mind watching Jerry Garcia play Dear Mr. Fantasy with Traffic. That'd be fine. It's just, I was saying about it, like, I was invited to go with the kind of college kids that you'd think would be Grateful Dead fans. And I couldn't imagine less, and I was such a straight-edge nerd at the time anyways. Like, I wasn't even drinking at this point. And I definitely, you know, my joke from stand-up stands, I wasn't cool enough so that I could be offered drugs so I could say no. I couldn't think of less of a good time than, or less of a time I wanted to experience than spending all day at RFK Stadium with a bunch of deadheads listening to meandering music of the Dead, all high as a kite, and I'm the only one who's not high.
I mean, as someone who smokes a copious amount of weed, I've never found the right cocktail to make the Dead interesting to me musically. They are the quintessential boomer, like, psychedelic rock band with all of those trappings, and a lot of which I find to be baggy and boring.
They're the least interesting psychedelic band from San Francisco in that time.
Yeah, that, right. No, there's like way more interesting.
Jefferson Airplane is
way
more
psychedelic.
Exciting.
Yes. Yeah. No, Jefferson Airplane's way more interesting. Like the, 1,000 times more interesting. I'm just talking about the airplane. But yes, I think that
not
like,
we built this city on rock and roll, Jefferson.
We built
Star
this city on rock and roll. I actually teach in a lesson about bad songwriting.
Marconi plays the mamba.
I actually break down that section in particular about all of the different things that are indulgent and flabby and bad. And we built this city on rock and roll. The one of the best things I ever found was the guy who wrote the song,
Martin Page.
The keyboard player. Yeah, he was talking about writing the pre-chorus to "We Built This City," which I think is awful and almost like unmelodic. And he was proud that he had stacked so many inversions on top of each other. He's like, "You don't really hear that in music a lot." I'm like, "Yeah, because it's bad." To circle back though to the Dead, here are the things I don't like about the Dead: the drummer and the bassist very often are not all the time. Yes, there are times where they lock together and make a pocket, but there are times where the drummer is just going boom boom da boom boom da, and the bass player is going boom boom ba ba ba, like doing something completely different from what the drummer's doing, and there's no pocket. Like if you just strip the Grateful Dead songs down to the bass and the drums, you're going to find, especially now with the magic of stems and everything, and the fact that you can do this on YouTube, that these songs don't often have really incredible rhythm tracks. And then I think Jerry's lead playing is very much
mid.
One size fits all. He does the same solo basically every time, or variations on that same soloing feel every single time.
I am the only fan of Martin Page's 1993 or 1994 song in the House of Stone and Light. So I just, my friends are like, that's the most uncool adult contemporary song. And I go, I kind of like it. It's a neat song. But yeah, I went into a Martin Page. He wrote a lot of songs. I mean, he was like one of those song factories for various bands during that time anyways, and then kind of got a hit on his own. But still, he's an interesting, somewhat cat. I think he went into TV songwriting as well, like for like some of those Disney band things, or maybe I'm mixing him up with Robbie Neville of all people. But nevertheless, Chris, I'm sorry to digress like that.
No. But yeah, the answer to everyone's question, we're not going to see the Dead.
And I'm not going to pay that much at the friggin' Sphere. Good God.
Look, if Fugazi does a reunion show, I will be disappearing for a week to go and see that, but I'm not, nothing else.
If they somehow reanimated the Beatles for a residency at the Sphere, I wouldn't pay that much money at the Sphere. The Sphere is going to just jack up the prices and kill you on that stuff. Well, maybe they resurrect the Beatles. Maybe. What is the best fast food chain, Chris?
The best fast food chain
does not have to be national. I've decided it can be a regional fast food chain if you so choose, because regional fast food chains are really the best to
okay
me.
but in order to be qualified as fast food, we have to have a drive-through.
Is there someone you don't like that? How many outlets does your Ricky's Hot Chicken or whatever have?
They've got a couple few, and I think they do actually probably have a drive-through now.
Okay, you can count that if you want.
I guess it would have to be Ricky's then. But if we are thinking, about chains that are more like chains, Golden Pride out here in New Mexico.
I've never heard of that. What is?
Yeah,
it?
Golden Pride is like they're based on they're a subsidiary of the Frontier, which is the big restaurant on 66 Central by across from the college. Does like breakfast and lunchy sorts of stuff.
Okay.
The drive-through there has killer carne adobada burritos. If you don't know what that is, look it up. You can get a burrito six pack, Jeff, for $13. Six carne burritos. $13. That is all the food you're going to need for the day, and get ready for some office time in the morning. like they've got that. They have killer breakfast burritos. Golden Pride's pretty fire. I stand a local legend. And then I really do enjoy In-N-Out Burger. I love going and getting the fries with the grilled onions and the In-N-Out
sauce. Animal style.
Yeah, but not with the cheese. I have to go cheese? Animal. I always have to say animal style, no cheese.
Okay.
Extra onions. Yeah, but and the same thing, I like doing my patties mustard grilled. If you haven't ever done that, they'll put the mustard down, they'll grill it on the mustard. I always like an In-N-Out burger. It's one of the things I do miss here in New Mexico.
The double-double animal style is a staple, and I tell people to do that. Well, why should I have to order something that's not on the menu? Blah, blah. Just trust me. Just do it.
That's the whole gimmick.
Like, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's just weird to me that people are anti that. Look, I love trashy gringo Mexican food, and Del Taco's fantastic. Look, Popeyes and Bojangles are great for chicken if you like those solo things. And even Sonic has a just a crappy selection of good hangover food.
Popeyes has the widest quality spectrum, right?
Because yes.
You go to Popeyes and it absolutely
slaps. It could be ass or be great. Yes.
Yeah, absolute ass, absolute great. And it's seemingly the exact same ingredients, but sometimes you have it. And I say seemingly, but like
if you go to Popeyes in a shifty neighborhood, you're taking your life into your own hands.
But you might also get the good chicken then.
You might. Yeah, no, that's true because, like, no, you're actually, now that I think about it, because I've had, like the Popeyes on Hollywood Boulevard, like right at Hollywood and Vine. Is it Hollywood Vine? Or no, it's Hollywood and Cahuenga. It is the most ass-tastic location. And the food sucks because it's like they're underneath the lamps for like hours at a time or something like that. Then you'll go to like a suburban one that can also be ass because it's like nobody knows how to fry chicken there. So yeah, you're right. I guess it just depends sometimes. But my choice, love the Bojangles, by the way. I love Culver's in the Midwest. I think they do great ice creams. Like if I'm picking a fast food place, it needs to have a wide selection of shakes. I don't know why. It just seems like that is something that I think a good fast food restaurant will have. Will have, you know, really good selection of shakes. And so I'm picking a mid-Atlantic chain called Cookout, which, whatever you're in the mood for, it's like going to a backyard barbecue because the smoke's coming out from the restaurant. Yeah, you get yourself a platter of mini corn dogs, a quesadilla, and a cheeseburger. And then like a banana and peanut butter shake, and you're happy for the rest of the day. That's all you need. It's cheap food. It's a lot of tiny foods because they have like a bunch of like just things that people like corn dogs and fries and hush puppies. And, you know, they have burgers, but they're not great burgers. They're not known for their burgers. Don't get me wrong. I love fast food joints that only do one thing well, which is why I love In-N-Out. But I couldn't have burgers for like if that was the only fast food chain on earth. So I do like the variety of Cookout whenever I can go and like get a Cheerwine float or something in North Carolina. It's actually one of those things I have to stop every time I'm in North Carolina and go to Cookout for some reason. So I really like that.
Couple other mentions here: Slim Chickens.
Never heard of that.
Yeah, chicken place has your desserts covered too. And then Dickies. You know, look, if you're on the road and you see a Dickies and you've been driving for a minute, that's about as good as it's going to get.
What do they do? Are they barbecue. Like a burger? Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I really like Taco John's. Have you ever been to a Taco John's?
I have not.
It's either Taco John's or Taco Time. I can't remember. But one of them has really good tater tots along with just the crappy Mexican, which are Tex-Mex. Just really, really strong.
Taco Cabana is pretty good too.
Taco Cabana is good.
Yeah. I'll shout out to Taco Cabana. All right.
Jack in the Box at 2 a.m. what has been your favorite off-air conversation? You want to go or should I?
I mean,
I'll go with one that we had. For some reason, we were talking music, and I can't remember if we were talking Muscle Shoals or we were talking just songs that had been canceled or out of rotation, but we got into this thing about like Into the Night by Benny Mardones and like other songs where it's like, It's kind of creepy that grown men are sleeping with teenagers type of thing, like Sexy and 17 and Let's Go by the Cars. And then somehow we got to reading the lyrics for Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones and just being absolutely horrified at some of the lyrics for that. Like, not even just like a black girl should. It's all about a dude sleeping with slaves and the wife is sleeping with another slave, and you're just like, ah, because you don't really get it just going quickly through the song, and you're just like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah, no, I remember that. I was fronting a cover band at the time, and I was having to sing stuff.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
And I was going through, and I was picking out songs. And one of my favorite solo sections in any, you know, piece of like kind of popular rock music to practice doing leads over, I just always find it, it's a joyous time. I love soloing over this thing, is the solo break in Brown Sugar. It's a standard little, it's the standard Keith cadence. He's not doing friggin' anything fancy at all. He starts on the flat three, goes back to the tonic, flat six, flat seven, back to the tonic. Really basic with this little sus force. But it is just a banger little riff. I love soloing over it. And I was like, you know, I was thinking about adding Brown Sugar into the set. And my bass player, who at the time, my best friend at the time, also black, and I looked at the lyrics to our utter mortification.
Yes.
And immediately decided that there is not a chance in hell I was standing on stage and singing this. I had absolutely no interest in it. So yeah, no, I definitely remember that conversation.
I
sure.
Bet your mama was a 10 show queen and all her boyfriends were sweet 16. I'm no schoolboy, but I know what I like. You should have heard me just around midnight. It's not even the worst one.
No. That second verse is pretty bad.
Yeah, it's the ones about drums beating cold English blood runs hot.
Yeah. God.
We went down a rabbit hole of things because I mean, the Betty Mardones song is just absolutely creepy because it starts out, she's just 16 years old, leave her alone. You're like, ah, no.
Well, and then the other thing, I don't have a specific conversation to link this to, but like we've had a number of times where we'll start talking about something and like we will then at one of or the other of us will end up on screen share and bring up like not like a fact check, like, you know, check your facts on this, man, more like, well, is that true? And then we're like looking it up and we end up learning something new or, you know, like some like weird factoid or something or other. I mean, I've had a number of those conversations.
Oh, I know the other one we had was about vice presidents and Charles.
Oh, yes. This is when I was doing the soundtracking for the Vice President series that Bruce Carlson did. He was Harding's president or vice
yeah.
president. Yeah. Interesting. Dawes, I think is his name.
Charles Dawes. No, you're yeah. correct on yeah. that. And he wrote the he actually had a number one hit.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
won a Grammy because of something in A minor, I believe is the name of the song. It's a violin song, but it's also used as
it was redone in the 60s in some capacity.
Yeah, hold on. Let me look that up. You vamp a little bit.
But yeah, I mean, those are the interesting ones. I mean, a lot of times I'll be doing something strange, like, you know, working on a mountain or, you know, writing music for vice presidents.
Coolidge's vice president.
Coolidge's vice president, yeah.
Nobel Prize winner, economics guy. Where is he as a musician? Let's get to that here. Oh crap, I can't find it, but he was a very famous violinist, and then like some 60s song used the same melody in it, so he later became like a Grammy Award winner. Dawes and Bob Dylan as a writer are the only persons credited with a number one pop hit to have also won a Nobel Prize. It's all in the game.
It's all in the
melody,
game.
Melody in A major, transforming it into the song It's All in the Game. Tommy Edwards' recording of All in the Game was number one hit on the American Billboard chart in 1958. There you go. That's we go down those types of rabbit holes sometimes.
Yeah, and those tend to be the most interesting. I mean, Occasionally we'll have politics conversations where I'll be looking up facts as we're chatting, and I'll end up learning something new one way or the other. Like, I'll be like, huh, I don't know.
I avoid those because Chris usually just slams the computer down and hangs up on me. So, all right, who is a wrestler people don't think is good that you enjoy, and who is a wrestler who is good that you don't enjoy?
Good that I don't enjoy, I'm going to hand to the Bucks. Like, they're not my cup of tea. They do a number of things that I think are contra to what I would consider to be good wrestling at times, especially 10 years ago when they could move faster. But they're clearly a good tag team that can do pretty incredible stuff. And they can do that stuff at a reliable clip. It's not like they duff or botch a lot of those moves on a regular basis. So I got a hand to the Bucks. Good wrestlers, I just don't like them.
And a wrestler that people don't think is good that you enjoy?
Well, here, you give me your good one. I'm going to think about a wrestler.
I don't enjoy Kenny Omega all that much. And it's not that it has nothing to do with his athleticism, though I find that to be more of a hindrance as a match goes on, because he's still running full speed when he's had all these moves done to him. It's more the style of not selling until somebody hits a finisher and gets a pin. But I also just find all of his emotional moments to be a little bit cloying and playing to the back of the room at all times. Like when he's fired up and shaking his hair like he's Hogan or something. I would go with that mostly. Really the correct answer probably is Zack Sabre Jr. Because his offense is always a playing with your food type of offense to me, as opposed to he's really trying to hurt somebody or grind a guy down enough to get a match or to win a match for a three count type thing. And while you're very entertained by all the weird interlocking, arms and legs and leg locks and stuff like that, he's not really trying to win a match. He's just trying to put on a show. And it's one of those things where I don't like, I want to see a guy like Ole Anderson come in and punch him in the face a couple times and see what he does with that. But I'm never going to get that in this modern indie style.
But other people think it's good. I'm going to go throwbacky on this one. Jerry Flynn is a name that has popped into my head a few times, where I don't think Flynn was this great wrestler, but Flynn threw cool looking kicks. He used to do this move where he would run from corner to corner, like on the diagonal with a rolling wheel kick, and yes, then do the wheel kick and land on the outside. I thought that stuff looked cool. Flynn, probably not a great wrestler or anything, but I found his matches and stuff to be pretty entertaining.
I don't know if he was a great wrestler, but to your sensibilities, I've been watching a lot of John Tatum. And the guy just has great facials and expressions and is everywhere and can bump like a chief. And I don't know if that makes him a good wrestler or not, but it makes him enjoyable to me. So that would be...
I think he is a good wrestler.
Okay, so I won't consider that. I've said many times on this show, I love the Barbarian. And I know a lot of people don't think he's very good per se, because all of his top line matches, like the time he got the WCW world title shot in Ron Simmons' first defense is famously a bad match. He's a giant hulked up dude. But for me, the Barbarian and that thrust kick he does, and especially in the Techwood Studios during a squash match, if he goes up for that top rope headbutt and is just basically flying into the lights, I love the Barbarian. His team with Dick Slater is one of the most fascinating things that I can think of in terms of what would they possibly talk about on a car trip with each other as U.S. tag champions. But I assume they got along in some way. But for me, it's the Barbarian. And of course, the Faces of Fear are just friggin' awesome. I love them.
And Sid is a bad wrestler, but I think he's like the best bad wrestler. We talked about that when he passed.
Yes.
He is the king of bad wrestlers, because he has such aura and such presence. And like, he looks like an effing star, and then like he can't do the stuff in the ring, but there's still just something endlessly captivating about him that you kind of forget about. I'll also add in Adam Bomb / Wrath. Huh. I don't think he was a good wrestler, but I used to really enjoy his matches.
Yeah, there are those types of guys that are like kind of big guys who are mid-level, but never really, you know, you can't look up something on Pro Fight DB and say, oh, look, they had a 4-star match once with somebody type of thing. No, those are usually in my wheelhouse. Like, I have a special love in my heart for the New Zealand Militia, which is Jack Victory and Rip Morgan. Just too big to, and they later became the Royal Family, which was an absolute embarrassment, but I always enjoyed them as a tag team. They just were never anything special. They were on that state patrol level. Another tag team I always kind of liked, but never really got their due, so to speak. Let's go to Vader Club. I gave Chris 1985's Midnight Express versus the Fantastics double ring no disqualification match from 1985's Parade of Champions for World Class Championship Wrestling. This was done in association with the NWA, and I believe the Midnights had just gotten to Crockett, but don't quote me on that. This is not a wrestling match in any ways. This is a fight, but it's one of those things where Chris picked Regal last week with the Belfast Bruiser, and Bobby Eaton came in, so it got me thinking about Dennis Condrey. And so I pulled the Novembrino. I went to Pro Fight DB to see what was the most highly rated match of Dennis Condrey's career, and it was this. I believe this is 3.5 or 4 stars for Dave. A fight with a ridiculous story. Jim Cornette had been interfering in the matches, so World Class had under contract a 7'5" guy by the name of Little John, who they put to sit next to him, much like actually WCW recreated this with El Gigante and I believe Ole Anderson, but for like a War Games or something like that.
They tried to get Little John to wrestle too, didn't they?
Yes, they did, and AWA had him for a spell, and then WWF brought him in for like a dark match taping, and it did, and because I think they were going to introduce him as a family member of Hillbilly Jim, because this is when they were bringing in giants who couldn't work to be part of the Hillbilly family for him. But I love Dennis Condrey. Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton are smooth as hell and a phenomenal tag team. But there's just something so Southern, and I use this term a lot, scuzzy. Jimmy Del Rey had it. Dennis Condrey had it, you know, the hairy chest. He looks like a 40-year-old, but he's actually 26. And they know how to fight, because you watch them throw punches, and all of their punches are awesome and are hitting the mark. A lot of people like the Midnights versus Rock and Roll. I am more of a Midnights versus Fantastics guy. The two rings are basically a gimmick. The ending is kind of contrived because, of course, the heels get the pin, but then right afterwards, the baby faces get a 3-count in the other ring. So who really won? You know, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a spot this match that I just adored. And because it's a no DQ match in two different rings, each ring has a referee. And Condrey brings in a, I think it's Condrey. Condrey brings in a chair to try and hit Tommy Rogers with. And David Manning gets in the way. And so Condrey just punches the ref. And I go, it's no DQ. That's perfect for me. I love that moment where the referee's trying to maintain order and get the chair out. And the guy goes, well, it's no DQ, punches the ref for a moment. You know, this is not a smooth tag team, twin brothers of different mothers type of working cornet style booked tag team match, but it is a fun fight. The Fantastics are really great. I mean, they're that genre of babyface that Chris and I talk about occasionally, where they would draw women in because they were sexy and they didn't want to see them get beat up. And that doesn't exist in AEW. Who are the young baby faces with great bodies that women would thirst over when they come in to watch AEW? I mean,
and if they had something like that right now, especially given that, let's say, the neckbeard quota is more than met, you would have that delicious, jealous energy.
Booing. Yes.
Yes.
Like the dynamic dudes circa 89, 90 or whatever it was.
That's great energy. That's fun energy.
I love that energy in a crowd where it's like, here's the pretty boys that all the women like, and all the guys who basically want to hook up with those girls are just like, they're not so good. I could have that kind of body if I worked at it.
Bitter booing. Love it.
I miss those types of, for lack of a better term, trashy crowds. I do in my wrestling. Everything is very upper middle class neckbeard stuff, and you're just like, I don't like it. But again, not a great match. Do you have any thoughts on this?
No, it's not my favorite. It's not my favorite midnight match or anything like that. And I've seen this match before. I liked the ref bump spot, and then there's another spot where I think it's Eaton's getting kicked in the corner, and he's just sandwiching a ref.
Yes.
He's got a ref behind him. That's very funny.
Yes,
that's,
where he's running to a ref, and the guy's stomping on Eaton, and so the referee is also taking the shots beneath him. Yeah, no, I liked that as well. That was really, really strong.
Yeah.
Your turn, sir.
So I gave us Shibata and Ishii from 2013's G1, a match that
was
at the time.
Was this 2013 or 2023? Because it said this, G1 23 on the video that I saw.
Yeah, but that was like the 23rd G1.
Oh, okay. My fault then.
Yeah. So it would have been 2013 here. You can tell because Shibata looks a lot skinnier here.
True.
He's not thick, but he's just really thin here. And Ishii doesn't have nearly as much frost on the temples. So this match at the time when we watched it was kind of considered an instant classic. Some people were dropping 5-star ratings on it at the time. I wanted to circle back to it because we had talked about Ishii and Shibata not that long ago on the show, and I said something to the effect of, it's strange having to convince people that Shibata was once a very good wrestler, but I swear to you, he certainly was. So I decided to go back and check out this one. I will tell you, repeat watch, I don't love it as much as I loved it at the time, with the exception of the finish. I really like the finishing sequence on this, where we go from a no count to a 2 count to a 3 count, like a full breakdown of Ishii. Ishii breaks down Shibata. First, it's all fighting spirit. Then he hits him again. Now it's a 2 count. Then he hits him a third time to finally put him away with the brain buster. I thought the finishing sequence on this was excellent. However, I will say, as the years pass, my relationship with strong style wrestling is a lot more lukewarm to slightly cold. I just don't find the forearm standing in the middle of the ring guarding nothing to be interesting. It's strong style is dumb style.
I agree. I want to see that the blows are affecting them. I want to see them sell a little bit, and then to come back and fire up as opposed to no selling these things. I do like the opening sequence a lot. The fact that it's 2013 has broken me a little bit, because the reason I love that end sequence so much is the brainbuster finishes Shibata off, and I thought this was post-surgery. So I'm like, of course that gives him the 3. That's a logical ending to a match in New Japan. But yeah, like the clotheslines all have a little bit of a stank to them. I love that. Look, it's not that I don't like Ishii. I just don't think he's a Hall of Famer. I think he's solidly mid-card New Japan, although...
Right, yeah. He is a legend of New Japan's mid-card. But
yeah.
I don't think he's better than Goto.
No.
Is Hiroki Goto a Hall of Famer? Probably not. I don't think Ishii is better than Goto.
Yeah, and I don't think Ishii is better than Arn Anderson. And that's always my guy that I compare it to. No, I enjoyed this, but I am with you, man. Strong style over the years has just worn on me.
You know what the other part of it is? My other problem with it is it eschews strategy. Strategy and match psychology goes out the window for a Eastern version of face, if you will, where I need to look strong. I need to, like, you know, and even in this match, it was like Ishii was trying to act like nothing was registering until he finally had to register some pain. I don't view it as narratively interesting as I once did.
I'm with you there. I like the, I'm a Southern style guy, so I like the heat segment of the babyface getting beat down and showing he's getting hurt and showing that he's struggling a little bit with this guy, because it also then helps the heel and for me to make him make me think he's a bigger badass right now. It's one of those things where there's this match, and then you get to the Omega Okada matches, which is just basically, it also eschews those things for set pieces, which is like, here's the big choreographed stunt we're going to do that pretends it does damage, where we're going to rest for about 15 seconds while people clap, and then we're going to get up and going to do the next set, versus quote unquote match psychology of I came in thinking I'm going to work on Okada's leg right now, and I'm going to continue to do that. Now there will be matches, modern day matches, where people will tell you that that's what they're doing on commentary or whatnot, and you watch the match and you go, no, they're not. You know, especially like during this Bryan Danielson retirement run, where it's like, well, you know, his neck's very sore. He's working on the neck right now. He stomped it once. He's not working on the neck as a strategy in terms of making the story of the match about that. I enjoyed it for what it was, but again, also Shibata is just really, since becoming the guy with the speakerphone, does very little for me these days.
I know.
He was the ultimate badass in 2013.
He was a cold assassin in 2013 that needed no nothing, and that's why you just simply called him the wrestler. But now on 24 or in 24, it's like here he is, the wrestler, Katsuyori Shibata, and he's like the translator. He's Google Translate.
And they're trying to figure out what word to emphasize these days. It's like the wrestler or the wrestler or the wrestler. It's like the old Richard Jenny thing. Well, let's cut off there. Go and enjoy our holidays. I am at CrapGame13 on Elon Musk's X. Jeff Hawkins at Blue Sky, if you choose to do that. You can just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. Chris is only on the gram at DOCTOR_NOV. That is Dr. Nove. We're part of Voices of Wrestling. You should know that by now. But we do have our own feed. I also do a show called over on Fight Game Media called The Dynamite Show. About 20 minutes after Dynamite, we go live on YouTube, except for this holiday, except on Christmas, because I'm not watching wrestling on Christmas. We'll probably go sometime on December 26th. Check the Twitter feed for that. But other than that, thanks for listening for this year. Chris, get your plugs in.
All right. If you are looking for guitar lessons, now's the time. Follow me on Instagram. Jeff just gave it out. It's DOCTOR_NOV. Do you want to check out my music? And I think that's all I got here.
We'll see you in 2025.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.